down by the water.
Welcome back to season 2 of the Run Culture Podcast. My name is Dane Verway. I'm an experienced running physiotherapist, coach, and marathoner. This season will involve open discussions with my running colleagues about the key principles behind injury-free running and optimal performance. It'll be backed by personal experience, science, and history. I can only hope some of these chats inspire curiosity and expand or confirm perspectives and beliefs amongst the running community. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome back to another episode of the Run Culture Podcast. Today I'm rapt to have Tom O'Halloran on the show. I went to university with Tom. It would have been some 13 or so years ago now. And it's been awesome to watch his progress as a physio and how he's evolved. He runs Mechanics of Movement, got quite a big following with that, and I've just been doing a few listens to some podcasts because it's only really been the last year or two that we've been back in contact, and just listening to his journey. So I reckon an awesome place to start, mate, is just how has your practice evolved as a physiotherapist? Because, well, introduce yourself, and how has your practice evolved as a physiotherapist? Because I think that's something that everyone can assimilate to when they hear someone's journey, because, you know, it starts out as one thing and then it very much transforms.
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, as you said, I think my last memory together in person was fourth year uni, where we were meeting our final presentation on patellofemoral pain and had absolutely no idea what we were talking about. And I think we're both probably, well, I was anyway, a bit of a struggling student. And yeah, obviously once we've graduated, we've actually turned that around and, yeah, invested a lot in education since then. So found our sort of our niche. Yeah, they were good times back at uni.
No, they were really good.
So basically I've had lots of different physio jobs over my time and probably predominantly in private practice, but the most enjoyable one came about when I got a job with the Defence Force. So I always had a real interest in, I guess, the gym and strength and conditioning and more like movement and movement skill. So I loved playing lots of sports growing up, footy, cricket, tennis, basketball, mixed netball, volleyball, skateboarding, surfing, just whatever I could do is very kind of active. And that was more my passion, the movement. And then when I was working, I guess in private practice, it became so much about the pain and the injury. And I would do lots of musculoskeletal courses on the spine, and everything was just so pain focused and pain as an outcome measure. And to be honest, it interested me for a while. And I did, you know, pain science and explained pain and went down the postgrad MUSC. Did the grad cert, so half of the master's, and just kind of realized I just wasn't interested enough to complete the full master's. And then, just kind of cruised in private practice for a while, just going through the motions, working 4 days a week, which was, you know, that was an all right balance because I wasn't doing sort of full 5 days, but I wasn't that passionate about it. And yeah, I wasn't that sure if I wanted to keep doing physio. And then, it just happened that I saw a master's through ECU that in Perth that you could do online. And I looked into it and I looked into the content and I was like, oh, this is the stuff I'm actually interested in. It's movement, it's gym, it's biomechanics, it's rehab sort of stuff as well. But the thing that I liked about it was no one in that profession talked about pain or injury. it was just all performance, function, and rebuilding someone or an athlete and just looking at things from a different perspective. So I enrolled in that and completed that over 4 years. And in the process, I actually ended up getting a job with the Defence Force. So moved up to Newcastle and worked with the Air Force and Army School of Infantry while I was doing that Masters online. And then with the School of Infantry especially, just saw so many lower limb and lower limb movement issues and shin splints and stress fractures. And we could spend, you know, 20 minutes with someone or 2 hours with someone. So the time was unlimited. I could take someone to the gym and just do a full program, full running assessment. So just got like lots of volume of patients that I could analyze. And yeah, just started to look at the different movement patterns, and you'd see the ones that were injured and the ones that just wouldn't get through. And often they were the ones that, you know, potentially grew up more as, you know, this is a generalization, but maybe as gamers, and they didn't have that early loading and that early kind of movement, and their movement patterns and mechanics were quite poor, and they're often floppy and pronated and, you know, no hip control. And often they'd end up with a lower limb, you know, stress injury somewhere along the kinetic chain. And then you had the other ones who were more the athletic ones who moved as kids, who, you know, got in because they were active and liked the active role in the Army. And you'd often sort of see that they would get through. And I'd just look and I'd be like, yeah, I mean, the research says movement and biomechanics don't matter, but and don't predict injury. But I think everyone has this different capacity to handle loads. And when the loads are high in the Army, you see the ones that are poor movers and were probably poor loaders when they were young break down. And I was like, there's something more to this than physio thinks. And yeah, then I finished the Masters. And as I said, I noticed the difference. And I did this 2 week in-person units in Perth, and we had to do a track exam, and it was me, I was the only physio, and there was like 20 S&C coaches doing this Masters or doing this last placement. And we had this scenario where we did a track exam, and it was an ACL patient who was returning to high level basketball, and the so we went in and we had to kind of come up with some agility drills and whatnot. And then we all came out, and then I remember chatting and all that everyone was saying, oh, what one did you get? So there's two scenarios, a soccer or a soccer hamstring or a ACL basketball. And it came out and everyone was like, oh, I got the basketball, or I got the basketball, I got the basketball. And then when they asked me, I was like, I got the ACL. I got the ACL. Did you get the hamstring? And so it was just like, we just looked at things differently. So they saw the person as a basketballer returning to basketball, thinking about the demands of basketball, how to cut, jump, change direction, how to help with their skill acquisition. And I saw the person as an ACL and a knee. And how do I help a knee, and what's the knee control, what's the hip control, without really thinking about basketball and the demands. And it just kind of summed up the difference for me between, you know, function and pain and injury. And I was like, physios, we have this hat or these blinders on where we're looking at pain and injury first. And we're not always considering the environment and the task and the demands and what the sport is. We're looking at knees, and we group things into ACLs and ACLs, and how do we rehab ACLs. And S&C guys, generalization again, I mean, they might look over injury and not see the injury, but they group things into sports and demands, and they'll be like basketballers, netballers, runners, and they then try and cater movement, rehab, performance around the actual demands of the sport. And so it just changed in me my practice in physio, where now I look at some of the physio research and it's like, well, what's the best, most current day practice for low back pain. And I look at that and I go, which lower back? Like lower back in a CrossFitter, lower back in a gardener, lower back in a cyclist, lower back in a wheelchair-bound person. Like you can't group injuries like that. You need to group people into the task and environment demands that they're going back to. And that's just such a clear picture for me now. And as I said, that changed the way I practice just from seeing a different world that I never saw before. And so then, I kept kind of working. I've always sort of kept working with defense, even as a locum physio, because I like the work and, you know, I think there's opportunities to help in some way or another. But I also work for myself, not in a full-time way. So I work at one of the unis and potentially at Deakin Uni next semester as well, and have another role with the Australian Physio Council. But the reason I have a few different roles is because for myself, I pretty much just do one form of assessment and treatment, and it's just a lower limb assessment. It's a little bit longer. It's fairly detailed. It looks at someone's movement, looks at their biomechanics, strength, power, often running, and then often I'll give guidance or advice on, you know, how to rehab this, or I won't always rehab it. Sometimes I'll refer back to someone and say, this is the direction. And for me, I guess that takes a lot out of me. So I really enjoy it, but that's why I do it two sessions a week at the moment, while I'm kind of building some other sides of my business as well, in education as well.
That's awesome, so, mate.
Yeah.
I reckon I've gone through a somewhat similar transformation or realization over the years. Started out in the physio world and sort of siloed in there and thought very much as a physio. But I remember about a month or so ago, we were just chatting, messaging each other, and we both sort of said, do you even refer to yourself or feel like a physio anymore? And it's we are titled physiotherapists, and that's what we're sort of label ourselves as, but it's almost like you're trying to think from a few different vantage points now.
I wouldn't say I'm not, but I associate more with skill acquisition and biomechanics than anything. I really treat people or patients or individuals as someone that I'm just trying to rebuild their function and not necessarily just rehabbing a specific injury or pain. I'm thinking around, how did that specific site get overloaded? Or what are this individual's limitations or constraints on their body or anatomy that we have to factor in and work around? But yeah, it is difficult because you are boxed into this one profession, and sometimes someone might even book in and say, oh, you're a physio, you can do this hands-on treatment, or can't you, you know, a friend, oh, I need you to come, I've got a sore back, come in. And I just kind of have had to say, no, I don't do that, sorry, anymore. This person's great.
Yep.
And I really, am pretty specific with what I do and who I see, because, I just can't work the other way anymore. And that's, that real interest in the movement skill more than specifically the injury. But another thing I did, so along that kind of path as well, I researched this 3D gait lab at Deakin Uni in Geelong, and I sort of looked it up and I was like, oh, that's actually really interesting. That's the stuff I'm interested in. So 3D motion analysis is basically similar to how they make some of the 3D movies, but it's using really high-tech camera systems to detect 3D motion of movement. And there's a running lab, or the 3D gait lab, in Geelong at the Deakin Uni, And yeah, 5 years ago, I kind of found that out, and I emailed one of the professors there and went in and chatted to him. And I was like, this is what I'm interested in. Like, how can I get into this? And so he said, oh, you could do some research, you could do some study, but I hadn't done an honours degree or anything, so I could have done an honours, but it was hard for me to do more PhD research. But yeah, he sort of showed me how to use the system, the Vicon 3D Motion. And then I did a little bit of work for Deakin where I assessed runners using 3D Motion as well. And basically, yeah, I think during COVID that sort of shut down, so I didn't kind of get to continue it. But I always maintained this interest in that biomechanics 3D movement. And I was like, this is a million-dollar machine here that gives a lot of info, but really some of it's really helpful, some of it's too much. And I was like, how could we make this assessment more accessible to the individual on the outside? And so slowly that's what I've tried to create. So I've got like a assessment called a Run Stronger assessment. And slowly I got some portable force plates, and I was like, okay, well, I could assess someone's strength, power, tendon spring, reactive strength with the force plates. And I was like, oh, well, how can I look more at running? How can I get more information than just my eye can see on a treadmill? And then looked into little RunScribe pods, which give me kind of some info on the forces on the body and the amount of time someone's spending on the ground and the amount of time they spend in the air. And then I've looked at another one called Run Easy, which looks at the forces acting on the body and is quite evidence-based compared to 3D biomechanics. But yeah, I guess, sorry to go off tangent, but in summary, my assessment has become and tried to link as closely back to what I learned in that 3D gait lab as possible. And it's just trying to get as much info on someone to work out where they're weak, where they're overloaded, whether that be an Achilles injury or a patellofemoral pain injury. I do exactly the same assessment. So I look at exactly the same measures and come up with normative data for, you know, what's normal for a female runner's isometric hip abduction strength? What's normal reactive strength for a male competitive runner on a drop jump? And so I've got these measures now where, again, they're more from healthy people. So when an unhealthy injured person comes in, so that ITB issue, and we measure and I'm like, no, actually your hip strength compared to norms are up. That's not the issue. But your isometric quad strength is down on that side. That's what you need to rehab. So it's kind of that same approach where it's just an assessment of the whole leg. Because the whole system is one, and when there's an injury, an overload injury, there's a breakdown somewhere in the kinetic chain, but it's not necessarily coming from there. And that's something that, yeah, I've noticed isn't really focused on, like, what are the norms in terms of, you know, quad strength for a runner? What are the norms of hamstring isometric strength? What's the normal single leg hop height for a female runner? Because then you can work backwards from there when you've got the person in front of you who's injured. So it's just basically what's healthy. So what's a healthy leg? And then when we have someone unhealthy or injured, where is the weakness there? And working it out from there.
Yeah, that's fantastic, Tom. Like, I find this really interesting because that's an area that I haven't been measuring, like, any of the normative data, but I've certainly been watching people run more and more, like, the way that I practice now just at home because I've got the time and so watching them in function. And it was really cool how you said, you know, it gives you a bit more idea of the whole system, like the body working kinetically together. Because like, so often in my early years as a physio, you sort of go, where's the pain? Oh, yep, there must be something around there. And you frame, you're sort of looking in those spots. But then suddenly, it's like what you said before, what does the person do? Oh, they're a runner. Okay, well, watch them running. And then how do their you know, how do all those key attributes of a runner function, and how is there any sort of chinks in the armor, like is there a weak spot?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's good, because like what are you tending to find? Like what are you tending to, like I know everyone's an individual and you're probably finding all different reasons, but
yeah, the main thing I'm finding, and I'll get back to what you just said in a sec, is glute med, so hip abduction, well down on generally injured runners. Calf strength endurance, so single leg calf raise. The hardest one about things like looking at hopping and drop jumps is part of that is coordination. So if someone isn't coordinated on a hop, they won't get height, but it's not necessarily that they don't have the power. It's they don't know how to express the power that is within them, basically. And that brings me back to, yeah, coordination. So as you said, like what you're doing is so key as well. And I do that as well. And I think of it, I learned this from S&C as well. The key to a good assessment is to be able to combine two worlds. And the two worlds are your quantitative assessment. So the numbers, the data, the science, the biomechanics, and then your qualitative assessment. So that's what we can see, our pattern recognition, it's the coordination, it's the understanding of movement patterns and shapes. And so I think a really good practitioner, and quantitative assessment can be, you know, the amount of single leg calf raises, the knee to wall, so that's still your quantities, but quality we can't measure. And so people try and measure movement quality, but if you measure movement quality, you turn it into a quantitative assessment and your assessment becomes unbalanced, because you need, and it's cliche, we've talked about this, but you need art and science. And so science is quantities and, yes, data, which we're getting more and more of, but you can't lose qualitative assessment and that movement quality, that movement skill, that coordination. And as we've sort of said, like it's too difficult to measure coordination. That takes a skilled practitioner to recognize shapes and patterns and understand the actual movement itself. So I guess like all the data I'm looking at gives me a strong quantitative assessment, but it doesn't tell me anything about how that individual moves through space and organizes their body and coordinates things. And runs as well. Like they might test perfectly and then, so they've got all this strength, it's there, but they don't know how to express it. They can't coordinate their body in space to utilize the quad strength that they have. And so therefore, you know, maybe they're at risk of injury because they have poor coordination, poor movement skill, poor movement variability as well. So yeah, you always come at it from two sides. And I think, again, if you want the strongest assessment, you have a strong both, strong both sides. But all data is pretty useless. But if we're all just, you know, relying on skill and just coordination, it can lack a bit of that objectiveness as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. This isn't a sales pitch, but it like leads pretty nicely to the app that we've both collaborated on this year, and just released it on the 1st of May. And we've done 12 weeks where you got me to, put in some videos of a lot of the key sort of skill acquisition exercises I've been doing with some of the athletes and that I've treated, and when I'm trying to get them to move with better coordination or move with better timing and in space. And it's through a constraints-led approach. And obviously like everyone's very different, and everyone moves very differently. So it's learning to move is just a process of exploring and working out what what sort of vibes with you as an athlete, but it's been fun because you certainly challenged me to sort of put some stuff on paper and video. Whereas a lot of it was just sort of like, I guess just intuitive, like on the spot, like what I do with athletes.
And that's what we sort of said. Yeah. It's like, we have made a generic 12-week program, but I think it's a very good generic 12-week program. It's not individualized, but, you know, if someone is looking for a running strength or skill program, I think it's quite a good quality one for someone that's, you know, not injured. And again, the reason why I kind of asked you, like I had created this already, but mine was just strength and it wasn't the skill coordination. And again, I like things to be balanced and I know my limitations. Like if I were to teach someone how to kick a footy, like an Aussie footy, I would be perfect. Like I know the skill, I have all right skills. I can see when someone has poor hand positioning, ball drop, follow through, whatever. I'd be really comfortable. But with running, like you're the skilled runner, I'm not. And so it's better to use someone who is really well versed in the skill and the injury to do the skill side, coordination side. And that was where I wasn't confident to be like, oh, I'll put all this running skill stuff in myself, because I'm like, I don't particularly know exactly what shapes and movements I'm looking for. Like I know the actual biomechanics, but I don't know what it feels like to run a 2-hour 20 marathon like you.
But so, like on that, like you can do that as an athlete, but then it's one thing to try to get someone else to feel that. Like I'm guilty of over coaching and over confusing people in the past as well. And then it's only really been the last 2 or 3 years where I've sort of gone, oh, hang on, this sort of constraint-led approach is, I've really gelled to it and really enjoyed it, because you get someone else to, through constraining the environment, like with hurdles or skipping ropes, to just feel what a quick ground contact time feels like without you overly like instructing them and just sort of almost confusing them and robotizing their movement.
Well, basically we talk about this again, but like for me, say injury comes down to overload injury comes down to two different, or we need to approach it with two different types of treatment approaches, so or three really. So if someone gets injured, they've overloaded, you can treat it from reducing their load, so you can, you know, obviously look at their running data and decrease their overall load so they can balance it and they don't get overloaded, because an overload is their body's, they've increased their load and their body hasn't handled that load, and it's result, rather than you know, building up and strengthening the tissues, it's resulted in tissue breakdown, whether that's bone, tendon, cartilage, muscle, whatever. So the loads have exceeded the tissue capacity to handle the load and they've got breakdown rather than, I guess, regeneration or strengthening. And so you can reduce load, you can improve capacity to handle load. So if that's a shin that's been overloaded, you can slowly rebuild that tibia and expose it to load to improve its capacity to handle more load. Or you can redistribute load around the body better. And so that's the thing that we rarely look at in physio. So we always look at that, the first two, where it's, you know, let's build it back up, let's improve load capacity, let's strengthen the tissues so that Achilles can handle more load that we're asking it to handle. But what if that Achilles is already doing far too much and, you know, the knee or the hip aren't doing enough, and we need to redistribute load and improve their efficiency of movement so it can take and shift that load away from the Achilles, because the Achilles already has capacity. We're just asking it to do way too much because the knee or the hip aren't doing enough. And that's where improving coordination and movement or efficiency comes in. And again, it's this balance, like the assessment, between sometimes we need to just rebuild tissue and it's just a loading issue, but sometimes this person just moves poorly. They've got capacity. They tested amazingly on strength. There's no issue with capacity. This is a movement skill issue. They're not moving in an efficient way to distribute load throughout the body, and they're getting injured or overloaded in one particular spot because of it, because that's just where they place load. And, you know, biologically or whatever, that tissue isn't designed or adapted for that amount of load. Like, every tissue structure in our body is structured in a particular way for a reason. And sometimes we're loading tissues that aren't that designed for being that loaded. Yeah. And when you go back to, say, coordination of running or any skill, so basically running is such an open game. So there's so few constraints on the body. So I can get from, basically all running is getting from A to B. And I can move from A to B in so many different odd running patterns and get the job done. And so I can still be effective, but that doesn't mean I moved efficiently through space to get from A to B. But there's not a lot of feedback. So say you're learning the skill of throwing a ball. And so say you have a really poor movement pattern and you're throwing this ball and the ball just travels 10 meters. And so you're like, okay, well, I got some feedback. It only went 10 meters. How can I make it go 15 meters? And you try the same technique and it still goes 10. And then you're like, okay, well, I probably need to change my technique here. And you change your technique, you move side on, you move the hips, twist the torso a bit. Oh, that went 20 meters. Okay. So you've got feedback from the environment and you've had to adapt and change your movement strategy. And then it's like, okay, well, that person 50 meters away, how can I throw? And so you start to change and organize your body in space to be more efficient, use more body parts, use your kinetic chain, because you're getting feedback from an outcome. And then if you add in, you know, different constraints, so say baseball, where you've got to throw over a small mound, you've got this tiny little area, you're always getting feedback from, so the brain, when the brain is organizing a movement, it makes a prediction in terms of what movement pattern to utilize to get the, to solve the problem. So the problem in throwing is going to be getting that ball from A to B as quick as possible without the opponent hitting it in baseball, I guess. And so basically, yeah, so you organize that movement pattern, and then you get feedback about whether that worked or not. And so if that ball went way sidewards, there's feedback, and there was a difference between the movement pattern you predicted and what actually happened, and the brain has to readjust and change and utilize a different movement strategy, and it learns then. So there's more learning if there's a big difference between what was predicted would happen and what actually happened. And then the brain can change and move and learn. And this happens from, like, when a kid's learning to walk, like I'm sure your daughter.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, they get up on 2 feet and so they're starting to move and walk, and at the start they'll fall down a lot. And falling is feedback to their system. Okay, well, that wasn't quite the right way to do it. Need to adjust the strategy. And this is obviously all subconscious. Need to adjust the strategy to find a better solution. And the problem there is, how can I keep the center of mass upright to get from A to B? So they're constantly getting feedback about their movement strategy, and they quickly adjust. Okay, well, that leg needs to be, the legs need to be wider, the arms need to be out. And slowly they start to learn, and that's motor learning, so movement learning. So the brain makes a prediction, and then what actually happens gives us feedback. And if what the prediction was is very close to what actually happened, then we know we're on the right path. There might not be as much learning. But if we predict something to happen and then what actually happened is far different, then there's a lot of learning to be done, and then we adjust the strategy. So this is any, like, movement skill. But again, running, there's not much feedback from the environment. There's not many constraints. And the constraint is basically like a boundary or a, and that can be within the individual. So a constraint might be, so basically any movement pattern is a direct result of the constraints around us. So they could be individual constraints. So if a runner has reduced ankle range of motion or dorsiflexion, that's going to slightly change their movement pattern because they can't get that ankle underneath them quite as far as the person with lots of range. So they're going to utilize a slightly different strategy based on their individual constraints. That might be an early heel lift. That might be they can't get the leg back into hip extension as much because the ankle's a bit stiff. So that's an individual constraint. But that could also be, you know, quads weakness. If there's some weakness in the quad, they might drop down into more knee flexion, or they might use the calf a bit more because they're working around that constraint. Then you've got environment constraints. So we'll change our strategy based on the environment around us. And sometimes that can be, obviously, environments like wind, but it might be the ground we're running on.
So hills, yeah.
Yeah, the ground cut me off if I'm going off on a tangent.
No.
So say you run on concrete, your brain will automatically adjust your movement strategy to make the leg less stiff, so more compliant, to adapt to the stiffness of the ground. And so the person who is really good at adapting their leg to that, to be more compliant, will run well and will enjoy running on concrete. But then as soon as you run on, say, sand, because the sand is compliant, the brain chooses a strategy to offset that, and it'll choose a stiff-legged strategy on a compliant ground. And so the leg has to change strategies to be more stiff. So some people don't mind running on sand, others completely collapse and they just can't adjust their strategy based on the changing environment. And then you've got task constraints. So that could be lots of different things. So in sport, say in cricket, you know, a task constraint in bowling is you're not allowed to bend the elbow at all, or maybe 10 degrees or whatever it is. And so in cricket, the goal is to get that ball. So basically, if you explained cricket bowling to someone, all you would say is, okay, you have to release the ball behind this line. You've got to try and hit those stumps. And you've got to throw that ball, but you're not allowed to bend the elbow. And so people find a way to get that done. And it happens that the best, most successful way to do that is to have a big run up, to run in, to jump, to keep that front leg straight, and to hurdle over that arm. So they find this movement strategy, movement solution based on the task constraint. So there's a rule there that says you have to keep that elbow straight. And there's lots of different examples of say how people use different movement strategies based on the constraints. And one of them is high jump. So the constraints, the rules in high jump are just, okay, you've got to jump over this pole onto this mat. And in years gone by, initially, there was no soft pad or mat to land on. And so the first high jumpers used different movement strategies. So they would go and I think they would scissor over it. They would do different techniques. And then someone introduced this soft mat. So basically, those high jumpers were just finding a movement strategy, movement solution to get over to solve this movement problem. And then all of a sudden this, I think it's Dick Fosbury, came up with this new solution, and he ran in and he almost dived over it over his back, which is the modern day, high jumpers technique, because there was this soft mat. So the task or environment had changed. He came up with this creative way of getting over the pole. He moved his body in space, or organized his body in space in a different way, and all of a sudden he could jump higher than everyone. But it was a really weird, creative, different way to jump, but it was still a solution, movement solution. And so then, yeah, over time, that became the standard way to get over the high jump. So that's just kind of how movement goes. So we have these different, like, no one tells cricket bowlers that's exactly how you have to bowl. No one ever told high jumpers that this is the technique. We think someone did, or coaches did, but at some stage it was just, here's the problem, find a way to get over it. And that's what you're kind of doing, or you and I both do within physio. We realize that you can't teach people how to move with explicit knowledge and with explicit cues. Like, our brain, our movement system is far too complex to break things down and to be taught like that. And the cues we give shouldn't be directed necessarily at the body. So what we should be doing is coming up with problems for the runner, the mover, to solve so that they can self-organize their body in space in the patterns of efficiency that we want, without needing any explicit knowledge, because that's how people learn. So they learn by solving problems, not by thinking with the thinking brain, like cognitively through things. Movement's not a conscious thinking skill, I guess.
Yeah, it's so fast.
A baby learns, like, you look at the two people that learn most to move. I always think of who's learning the most. And I think a baby, a toddler, and someone recovering from stroke. And so both those two groups aren't utilizing conscious thought and cues. Yeah. The brain is learning unconsciously through solving problems that the neurological physio is really good at creating, and that the environment is really good at creating for the toddler.
Yeah.
And so why do we then, you know, try and teach these athletes or patients with all this conscious cognitive stuff when we're trying to get them to learn as well?
Yep.
So we should be learning off the learners, which are the ones who are, you know, really learning all these movement skills, changing their brain, neuroplasticity, you know, understanding that neuroscience side of it as well. Maybe. And I guess, yeah, sorry, you go.
Oh, you just touched on so many good points. And like relating that to running, I feel like when you look out, say, at the local park run, like, I just watch so many runners where I'm like, oh, I feel like you could be moving better if you, like, appreciated that you could. Like so much of our environments are just concrete and very tame. There's no variability. So we just run, and we run slow. So there's no pressure to move better. Like, we're not getting chased by a tiger. Pressure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's also, like, no feedback, like you said. So we don't know if that was the most efficient way to move.
Exactly.
Because it is effective. We're locomoting from A to B, but could it be more efficient? And we're not getting that feedback. So we just get stuck in the way that we move, and it's socialized that our biomechanics, in a lot of the research, you know, they're not really suggesting that, there's a bias to just go, oh, just focus on strength. In society at the moment.
Yeah, and I think because you're better at, you know, looking at running as a skill, I'm pretty good at looking at things like squatting and hinging at the hip and hopping. And to me, I think you can also make someone just a better mover, a more coordinated mover, because there's patterns in running such as, you know, getting triple extension from the hip, knee and ankle at push off, and being able to hold good pelvic positions. So for me, I approach it a bit more. So I might, you know, teach someone how to jump, because jumping involves triple extension, because they've lost the ability to coordinate that movement between ankle, knee and hip at the same time to produce power into the ground. Or I might teach them how to hop and utilize that ankle stiffness well and be able to get off the ground quickly, because I'm thinking of making a better mover here. And that's how I approach, because I don't just see runners, I guess, I approach it from how can I make this person a better mover? What are the fundamental patterns that I kind of want them to focus, to be able to do? And so, and for me, they're usually around, you know, kind of organizing a squat, a jump, a hop, a hinge at the hip, holding good sort of pelvic positions and, lunging, that sort of thing.
You talk a little bit about the spring mass model online, and I don't reckon enough runners understand it. But I think it's a good segue into the spring mass model, because thinking of your leg like a spring, I think it's a good concept for runners to understand, because a lot of us don't actually run utilizing our leg as a spring.
Yeah. So if you looked at someone run, especially someone running slowly, it doesn't look like the leg is a spring. So they don't look like a kangaroo. So basically your quintessential spring is your kangaroo leg. Basically a kangaroo, when they're hopping, basically a kangaroo, when they're walking around on all fours, they're really, really inefficient. But as soon as they start hopping, they become one of the most efficient mammals, marsupials, around. And they're so efficient because they utilize their springs. So all their energy is elastic energy, or 97% of it. Basically, they're just recycling this potential kinetic energy as they spring along on these long Achilles tendons, long probably plantar fascia. And so in our leg, we have these same springs, but not to the same extent. So our springs basically help us utilize this thing called elastic energy in our tendons. So we store energy in our tendons and it's released for push off. So when we run, basically we'll hit the ground and we always then bend. So bend into our ankle, bend into our knee, bend into our hip. And by the time of mid stance, when, you know, that leg is directly under our center of mass, we've actually dropped down a little bit. So our center of mass has dropped down. And so this has happened because we've bent at these three joints. So, you know, we hit down, our leg's a little bit straighter at, say, the knee. Then we start bending. And then as we go to push off, our leg then re-straightens. So it's basically this kind of drop in our center of mass. And this drop is mainly due to that bent knee, bent ankle position. And so during this drop, we actually load what's called our leg spring. And if you think of like a pogo stick, so basically when a pogo stick jumps up, when it starts to land, it starts to compress. And that compression within the pogo stick is energy stored in the spring, and then it springs out from that position. So that's exactly what our leg does. And basically with this compression of our leg spring, we don't want it to take too much time. So basically if that leg spring compresses too much and we bend too much into the knee and we drop down our center of mass on the ground, we become what's called too compliant. So our leg is kind of just deforming, compressing too much under gravity. So gravity is kind of beating us. Gravity wants us to just drop to the ground. And if we're too compliant, we actually drop too far down to gravity before we beat gravity and then push back out. And this results in a long ground contact time, because it took us a long time to overcome gravity and to we dropped into our spring too much. So we want what's called... for efficiency, we want a pretty stiff spring. So we want to hit down. We don't want to compress the leg spring too much, but we're obviously always going to get some compression. And then we want to be able to spring out of that position. So we don't want to drop the center of mass too much. But in this compression of the leg spring, this is where we store that elastic energy in the tendons. And it's only kind of available to us if we're spending shorter periods of time on the ground. So if we were too compliant, we dropped down too much, we spent too long on the ground, it's too much time for that elastic energy to be utilized and released. It's actually lost as heat in the process. So this is where ground contact time comes in. If there's a short ground contact time, someone compressed the leg spring a little bit, but not too much. They stored elastic energy in the tendons and then they released that energy, and it was that short ground contact time. So that's kind of the spring mass model. And it's not just running and it's not just humans. So it's pretty much, you know, lots of different mammals and two-legged animals utilize these same springs. So they're pretty universal. And we all, lots of different animals have it to a different extent. And it really accurately describes how the leg interacts with the ground. And as I said, There's different ways to change your leg stiffness or your leg spring. So one will be, and it goes back to those three things we talk about, you can change the environment. So if you change someone's environment on sand, someone will automatically change their leg stiffness to become stiffer. They'll have to adjust. Those that can't and can't adapt will fall or will, you know, be very, very slow. You can change. So we use this leg spring for different movements too. We use it for hopping and for jumping. So on hopping, so you can change the task. So if you get someone running to a metronome and increase their cadence, you know, not always the right thing to do, but sometimes. If you get someone to run on a beat and they're off the ground quicker, you change the task constraint. The constraint is, you know, all the brain's thinking, land and beat, land and beat, land and beat. We'll self-organize a strategy to make the leg spring stiffer to get off the ground again. So that would be changing a task constraint. Or you could set up, obviously, some of your running drills. You change the task. Someone's going to be stiffer because, you know, there's that time pressure. The metronome is just time pressure as well. Or you can change someone's stiffness through strength and conditioning. So, you know, getting that eccentric quad strength, calf power, you change the individual's weakness, and that will hopefully change that leg stiffness as well. So, you know, it goes back to that skill thing. Leg stiffness, how stiff someone's lower limb is or how compliant it is a result of the constraint interacting on that individual. So the environment, we can change that. The task, we can change that. And the individual characteristics or constraints, we can most of the time change that as well. So we can adapt this stiffness. And that's what the key to, yeah, having a well-rounded, adaptable, strong, resilient, robust, efficient lower limb is to have this really good leg spring. And so that's a lot of what I do with S&C. I'm always thinking, how can I improve this leg as a unit to be springy and stiff, to be able to overcome gravity quickly, spring back out and store elastic energy in the process.
Nah, that's fantastic, Tom. Yeah, I don't know. That's all I had, like, in terms of what I wanted to chat about. Like, I think you've really summarized it well in terms of the motor learning and getting people to appreciate that we should think about coordination as well as strength. But
I think for me, it's just like, I don't know, I think it'd be really good if physio slowly over time started to embrace more of the motor skill acquisition, and also to maybe break movement down again, like we have into professions, into silos as much, as in like running is running, walking is walking. It's like movement is movement. And so like if you might give a running drill and like all fours crawling, and like it might look odd, but you're still trying to get some form of coordination between limbs. You're trying to get someone to control maybe the pelvis. You're still getting, you know, them to push through that scap. And so like, yeah, we shouldn't always break things down into like, you know, this is this movement, this is this. It's like, if we can make people better movers to organize themselves in space, that's going to have a lot of implications for the rest of their life. So I think that would be key. If we could like help at least educate, you know, some people and practitioners to move a bit away from pain and more towards creating a society, especially in a more sedentary, indoor, technology-based society, if we could get people to appreciate movement and movement as a skill more so, then that can decrease, you know, that approach, I believe, would reduce injury risk if you can make a society more focused on movement skill and variable movement.
No, definitely. If anyone wanted to reach out to you, Tom, where can they find you? And then the other thing is, with the app that we've collaborated with, where can they find the Run Stronger app?
Yeah, sure. So probably Instagram mechanics underscore of movement, or mechanics of underscore movement, is the best place. And I just put out exercise videos and education as often as I can. And again, the reason I created the app in the first place was that I was getting people coming in for running strength programs. And I found that a lot of the time I was programming the same thing, and it would be a squat, a hinge, some calf strength and some hip control. And then I'd see them, you know, a few weeks later, and I'd progress it towards strength and then towards power and plyometric. And I was just like, one day I thought, I'm just going to create a 12-week program and I'm just going to, you know, give it to this person, or, you know, I'm going to offer it to the person who's in Alice Springs and wanted a Tally Health running strength program. I was like, just try this app, try this program. And I was like, this is actually a little bit easier way to do it for someone that maybe can't come in. And here's how we can use some of our knowledge to reach these people who might not have access to someone who understands strength and conditioning or movement skill, or hip control. And, you know, this is the best way I can think of reaching more people with that kind of capacity coordination approach. And so, yeah, the app's available. Easiest probably to go through Instagram, social media. There's a link there. And there's a free 4-week just at home sort of beginner strength program that you can try. And there's a 12-week running strength and skill program with exercises from Dane and I. And yeah, we're always sort of trying to improve it and looking for feedback on it as well. So it just kind of, for me, it's touching those two worlds of improving someone's movement, but also understanding how important just capacity, strength, load capacity is as well.
Awesome, mate. Always a pleasure.
And, yeah, you too, mate.
Yeah, have a great rest of your day. I better head off.
Yeah, I'll chat to you soon, mate.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks for jumping on, and we'll stay in touch.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. See you, awesome, mate. Tom.